Good morning, everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce our first invited speaker for today, Drew Perves. He is a person who models ecosystems on a global scale, and he spent many, many years trying to figure out how to model biodiversity with many different tools, and also how all these changes that humans affect to ecosystems will lead to changes in the ecosystems. He developed quite a number of tools for this, and also got many awards, like, I just need to look on my list, he got, 2012, he got awarded as the list of smart people who changed the world by the Wired magazine. 2013, he was selected as a young scientist by the World Economic Forum. 2014, he was nominated among one of the people with the top 10 scientific discoveries. In 2015, he was named a big data star by the Fortune magazine. So you see, his research not only has impact into the research community, but also into more the public media. So we're very glad to have him here. Drew did his Bachelor of Science in the University of Cambridge in ecology. Then he completed his PhD at the University of York. He had a postdoc period in Princeton, and then for quite some time was at Microsoft Research, where he was heading the computational ecology group. And last year, he moved to DeepMind, and now he's going to talk about intelligent biosphere, and I'm really curious to know what it is.
Well, a huge thanks to Ula and Isabel for this unexpected and frankly slightly nerve-wracking invite to give a keynote at NIPS to this titanically huge audience, which I've calculated is probably larger than all of the previous audiences I've spoken to combined. So if I do a bad job today, that means on average, my talks have been bad, which is quite nerve-wracking, but hopefully I won't, we'll see. So I thought a bit about how to frame my talk today in a way that would be useful for this conference, and I think that I came up with this scheme, and see if it makes sense to you, which is this idea that nature needs AI. I shouldn't call that an idea. I think this is actually an incontrovertible fact, that nature needs AI, or machine learning, or data science, whatever we choose to call it, but nature needs AI. And I'm going to talk a bit about that, but the second part of my talk is about the fact that AI needs nature. And this is represented here in these illustrations that our in-house artist, Max Kant, has created specifically for this talk, so get used to these slightly strange diagrams. So in the diagram on the left there, nature is represented as the possum, and it's ill, and the possum is being rescued by AI, represented as this kind of slightly robotic-looking, digital kind of creature there, who's trapping a virus and helping to rescue nature from this particular wildlife disease. Whereas on the right, the idea that AI needs nature is represented there by Professor Walrus explaining the biology of mammals to AI. So AI, nature is teaching AI. And they're the two halves of my talk today. Nature needs AI and AI needs nature. So as an introduction to the first part, nature needs AI, I feel I should mention the fact that when I was asked to give this talk, I was still in my previous position at Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK, where for about 8 years I've been leading a group called the Computational Ecology and Environmental Science Group. And the mission that we declared for ourselves in that group was to build forward predictive models of different aspects of the Earth system. And the models varied a lot. This venue's too large for a laser pointer to work, so you might have to work out which ones I'm referring to. But there's a model that depicted there which describes an annual plant called Arabidopsis. It's a very, very small annual plant that grows to about the size of my fist and lives its entire life over around 30 to 60 days. Whereas the models ranged up to models that describe processes like the global dynamics of plankton and oceanic productivity and the terrestrial carbon cycle, processes that occur at global scales and evolve over timescales of decades to centuries. And in between, we touched on ecological networks like food webs and some human processes like agricultural productivity and Amazon deforestation. So although the models varied a lot, what bound them together was a desire to create models that were very carefully constrained against data, by which we mean that the parameter values, so the parameter values that are used to execute the models are very carefully estimated from data, along with the uncertainty on those parameters, and that the uncertainty was propagated through into the model predictions. And we had this phrase, defensible models, in the sense that if those models were interrogated in court, we could explain where the functional forms and parameters came from and explain that we'd done the best job available on the uncertainty on the predictions. Now, I would imagine for a lot of people in this room, that seems a no-brainer. Of course you would do modeling like that, right? You'd have a proper separation of training and test data and all the rest. But at the time, and even now, that isn't really the norm in biogeochemical and Earth system modeling. Those models tended to have been assigned by hand and hand-tuned. And so in doing that kind of work, we made all sorts of conclusions about various aspects of the Earth system, and were able to make some predictions about how some of those components might evolve in the future under a business-as-usual scenario or under various alternative policy scenarios involving things like cutting back on emissions or declaring protected areas in the Amazon and so on. So it was a really fantastic time at Microsoft Research. We had a group that was a real privilege to work with, and it led to a lot of scientific articles. But the background to all of that work, and the background to my work now at DeepMind, is slightly more serious than that. It's the fact that the Earth needs saving. And I know this is the bit that everyone expects an environmental scientist to do, and hopefully you'll see that I'm a kind of inherently cheerful and optimistic person. I think we will save the world, but we do need to be honest that it does need saving. So the world is facing a raft of unprecedented challenges at global scales, all ultimately resulting from a human population of unprecedented size, which is consuming ever more resources on a per capita basis. And in fact, about half of the world, the poorer half of the world, really needs to keep increasing its consumption so that those people can have what we would think of as a decent life anyway. And those two factors together are stressing every aspect of the Earth system. The climate is a familiar one, of course. So the energy, carbon dioxide, climate nexus is a real concern for all of us. My favorite statistic from this year is that 15 of the 16 warmest years on record globally have occurred this century. Just think about that for a second. 15 of the 16 warmest years on record have occurred since the year 2000. And there are many, many other bits of proof and evidence of the way we're stressing the global climate system. But climate change is far from the only challenge. We're really concerned about global food security, as we are salinating various of our soils. We're concerned about the resistance of various agricultural pests to the chemicals that we use to control them, and so on. We're also worried about medical problems like diabetes, antibiotic resistance, and on it goes. So this is the really depressing bit. And I know it's first thing in the morning, so I'm sorry to be a little bit down on that. Also, these challenges interact in ways which I think are not that hard to understand, but are still not widely discussed. So for instance, we had the Green Revolution in the past, where we hugely increased agricultural yields across the world. And that was an amazing achievement, which has kept the world fed. But the truth is that was achieved by a huge increase in the inputs into the agricultural system. So if we were to try and increase yields again by doing the same thing, then that's just going to have huge knock-on effects on the climate system. So we could not do that, and instead we could clear more land for agriculture, but the remaining land is in the tropical rainforests, and if we cut that down, that will also release lots of CO2 into the atmosphere and have disastrous effects on biodiversity. So we're reaching the point now where we can't solve one of these challenges very easily because of the way they interact with the other challenges. But the good news is that AI and ML and data science has a huge role to play in addressing these global challenges. And I think that we can think of that in two halves. And on the left half there is the idea of efficiency savings. So the good news is, when we look at these various, if you like, global life support systems that we depend on, like the agricultural system or our energy systems and so on, if you look at each one, you find enormous inefficiencies, really huge inefficiencies. Like we waste approximately 40 to 50% of the food that we grow is never eaten by a human. That's absolutely ridiculous. Our electricity networks are geared up to overproduce by about 30 to 40%. We hugely overprescribe antibiotics and herbicides on our farms and so on. And so, of course, this raises the possibility of shrinking the size of some of those inefficiencies. And the other part of the good news is that when you dig down and ask why are these systems so inefficient, nearly every time it comes down to key aspects of that system being unpredictable. So being viewed as unpredictable. And in response to that unpredictability, we have built in enormous safety factors into our systems. So we overgrow food because it's very hard to predict agricultural yields or the demand or price of food. We overproduce all kinds of goods because we can't predict people's demand for it. We have to gear up our power networks to overproduce because we can't predict the supply from renewables and the demand for electricity. I'll give a shout out to Zico Zolta, who brought me to NIPS a few years ago in a group called ML Sust. I mean, he works on the electricity network using machine learning methods. So what this implies, quite literally, is that if we can predict stuff like that from data, then we can make a massive inroad into some of these huge inefficiencies. And that's what you guys do, right? Predicting stuff from data is kind of the bread and butter of machine learning. And so it's just really important to realize that being able to do that can have an enormous impact. And towards the end of my time at Microsoft Research, for example, I spoke to some large companies with large environmental impacts in things like the agricultural sector, utilities and power sectors and so on. And time and again, we would find that the biggest business problem faced by those companies was also a huge environmental problem that could be, if not completely solved, certainly hugely reduced through the use of machine learning and data science. So I'd really encourage anyone here to think about trying to use their skills in machine learning and data science and AI to address some of these huge global challenges. In doing so, you can feel really good about the fact that you're contributing to the continued existence of human civilization, no less, which we shouldn't take for granted unless we solve these problems. But also, I would predict with confidence that that kind of work will take you into new territories in terms of your research, new models, new algorithms, new data sets, and so on. And based on the experience of our group at Microsoft, I could also say that it probably won't do your career any harm in terms of publications either. And so I'd really encourage you to think about using your skills in that way. We've really barely scratched the surface of what machine learning and AI could achieve in terms of addressing these global challenges. On the other hand, I think if we look at the magnitude, the complexity, and the interactions among these global challenges, it's not obvious that we can get out of these problems through efficiency savings alone. And this brings up the idea of using advanced AI to help us make radical breakthroughs. I think the way you can think about this is that efficiency savings are about doing what we can within the current limits of technology, whereas radical breakthroughs are about using advanced AI to try to change the very limits of that technology. So just as an example of that is the idea of reprogramming plants. We see the sloth here programming this ginger plant to have an extra arm in this particular case. And this might sound ridiculous, but there's a lot of interest and actually a lot of progress in reprogramming biology that's occurred over the last few years. This is not as wacky an idea as it sounds. So just to give you a couple of pointers, examples about what that could achieve. So if we look at our staple crops, the plants that we depend on for the vast majority of our calories, they're still highly constrained by the biology that was inherent in the wild plants from which they were developed. So one example is that for ecological reasons that I can't explain right now, but there are good ecological reasons why those plants in nature that evolved to invest heavily in seeds, which is what we need because they're very nutritious, happened also to evolve to be annuals. So what an annual does is the seed, once it lands on the ground, it germinates, and it starts really, really small, and it has to build the root and the stem and shoot system through the year. So first it builds the roots and the stems and leaves, and then, once it gets to a certain size, it then shifts to producing seeds, and it has a programmed death of the roots and stems. That's an annual plant. And that's really problematic because it means that all that investment in the roots is just thrown away. And it also means that early stage of development, the plant is very vulnerable. So it's no coincidence that in nature, the most productive plants are perennials, plants that slowly grow the stems and roots once and reuse them year after year. But in nature, perennials didn't happen to evolve to invest heavily in seeds. So if only we could work out how to reprogram our wheat plants to be perennial, that could have a huge impact on global agricultural yields and food security. Another example is that in nature, there are many plants that evolve to create their own nitrogen fertilizer in their roots through a mutualistic interaction with bacteria, which at ambient temperature and ambient pressure can rip the nitrogen out of the air, split the molecules, and put that nitrogen into a form that can be used by the plants. But it just so happened that none of our staple crops evolved that trick. So instead, we do it for them using the harbor process, which requires extremely high temperatures and extremely high pressures. The harbor process alone uses 1% to 2% of global energy on a single chemical reaction that bacteria can do for free. But the problem is that we don't know how to engineer those bacteria into the roots of the plants. And moreover, when we put that nitrogen on the fields, 75% of it drains away and is not used because they don't have a root system yet, because they're annuals. So we know the kinds of things we'd like to do to reprogram plants to change the limits on our food system. But doing it probably requires advanced AI. It's extremely difficult to do. We have to trick the immune system of the roots of the plant, for example. We have to rewire that immune system so that it actually lets in, allows itself to be infected by just the right bacteria. And we just don't know how to do that kind of hacking of nature yet. And although we'll probably solve some of those problems through human effort, it's very likely that we're going to need advanced AI that can help us crack those problems. So that was the nature needs AI. But what about AI needs nature? And I think this is the part that's less orthodox, I suppose, more speculative, and that I thought about a lot specifically for today's talk. So the idea here is that one thing we do know is that all known advanced intelligence evolved in the natural environment, the real natural environment, forests, oceans, swamps, the soils, this kind of thing. And one of them, the human species, got so advanced. So that's the bottom right quadrant there, the real natural environment. And one of these species, us, got so advanced that it changed its environment so much that it now lives in an artificial environment, largely. Modern humans live largely in artificial environments that we've designed ourselves to be logical and sensible to us. So when we're developing advanced AI, as we all know now, we need to create these interactive, complex, virtual worlds. We call them environments at DeepMind. That's a language that's inherited from reinforcement learning, of course. So this is an environment, is a little virtual world that you drop an AI agent into in order to train it or test it. The most intuitive thing for us to do is to create virtual artificial environments. Environments that, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that a little bit more. A lot of my talk is about the differences between artificial and natural. And so there's a slight contradiction here in the sense that we know that real intelligence evolved in the natural world, but most of the environments we're currently using to train and test our AIs are very artificial in nature. And this raises the possibility that we are overfitting to the artificial. If artificial environments are very different to natural environments, then we can't expect our AIs to be able to transfer over to the kind of noisy, non-stationary, cyclic, networky problems that nature throws up. Problems like reprogramming plants. We'll be like Mr. Squirrel here, who thought he was doing really well in his learning as long as he was in that VR world. But now he's taken off the headset, his diploma's gone blowing off in the wind, and he's hitting the exit button. So before I go on to talk about these differences between the natural and the artificial world, I want to explain a little bit about my perspective on what intelligence actually is in nature. According to my definition, all organisms are intelligent. It's not that intelligence is part of the definition of life, it's just that in practice, all living things have evolved to become intelligent. They all receive inputs from the environment. They all store internal states and compute against those states. And then they use that computation to calculate an optimal action that will improve their fitness. Now, and this happens in everything, all the way up from amoebas. So for example, an amoeba, if it senses that the environment is getting harsh, starts sending out signals to communicate with other amoebae. And if there's a sufficient quorum of support, then the amoebae go into this so-called encysted state. They grow a hard shell around themselves, and they drop their metabolic rate by 99% or so, and the remaining 1% is devoted to simply monitoring the environment, see if it's got better. So, and then when it does get better, they come back out. That's an amoeba does that, okay? That's like the most stupid thing just about you can imagine. Has that kind of sophisticated intelligence. So all, as we come further up, we find much more advanced intelligence at every level of life. Now, interestingly, these forms of intelligence all seem to be encoded in various forms of networks, or at least the ones we're aware of. So, but it's not always networks of neurons. I think we're a little bit too quick to make this analogy between brains, between deep learning and brains in AI research. When I first learned about how training deep learning actually worked, it seemed to me that the analogies were probably better as something like networks of genes communicating through proteins. We also have networks of cells communicating through hormones and other chemicals. Yes, we have the networks of neurons, the more familiar part. But we also have networks of individuals communicating socially through sound and vision and smell, etc., etc. Now, I'm not saying that these are all the same. They're not. They're different. But it's not obvious which of those has the closest mapping to deep learning as it's done today. So I'm not going to say much more about that, but the idea is that everything's intelligent. We have an intelligent immune system, intelligence sitting inside our cells in various forms, as well as the more familiar intelligence that sits within brains. Okay, so on to some of these differences then. How am I doing for time? I've lost track already. I've got 15 minutes left. All right, a little bit behind. I thought I probably would be. So I'm going to skip through some of these a little bit quickly. So let's first look at some of the differences in the physical world between the natural world and the artificial. And again, as a reminder, when I say there's artificial and natural as opposed to real and simulated. So I'm talking about artificial here versus natural. So it's the difference between a forest and an office. Whether that's a simulated forest or a real forest isn't the point. So the first thing to note is that the natural world is scaleless and cyclic. There's no single dominant spatial scale in the natural world. Neither is there a single dominant temporal scale. Everything tends to be presented as a fractal power law type pattern, structure, or distribution. Even things like the frequencies of different kinds of objects, for example, they're always some kind of power law or log normal distribution. So we never find the kind of even distributions that we're used to. And contrast that with the artificial environment, which is highly scaled, no coincidence, around the scale of the human body. The human body, the human hand, human finger, and so on. Look at this room. So we have this environment that's full of right angles, flat surfaces, and which it has a strong dominant scale around a human. Nature is completely different to that. Now, layered on top of that, resulting from the simple fact that the Earth goes around the Sun and the Moon goes around the Earth, we have these cycles within cycles when we're looking at temporal patterns. And interestingly, all known living things on Earth have an internal representation of the diurnal cycle. So even bacteria and amoebae and so on have an internal clock that they use to estimate where they are in the day, because everything is trained on there. And most living things on Earth actively sense the time of year and condition their behavior on the time of year as well. And there are many examples also, of course, of conditioning biology and behavior on the time of the month, including in female humans. And this raised the question of how do you factorize space and time in the natural world? And I don't think we know, but I think we can be quite sure that it will be a different way than the best way to factorize space and time in the artificial world. Now, as if that wasn't bad enough, the natural world is also fuzzy in the sense that all the objects and the interactions in the natural world are unique. Like Ms. Mole here. I think she's my favorite character. She's really cute, isn't she? But well done, Max. Ms. Mole has got confused. She thought she was doing quite well classifying the rocks and pebbles, and suddenly she's come across one that's somewhere in between. So because every object and interaction is unique, there's never an unambiguous classification of anything in nature into a set. Contrast that with an artificial environment like here. There's no doubt that these are chairs in front of me. These chairs began as a concept of a chair in a human's brain, and that human designed the chair and created 5,000 and odd identical chairs. There's nothing analogous to that in the natural world ever. Every object is unique. So concepts don't exist. And this completely kills discrete logic. If you can't classify things into sets reliably, it kills traditional discrete logic. And then it requires what I would call conceptualization. So instead of an approach where you seek to discover the classes of objects that truly exist in the world, instead you have to invent a conceptualization, a set of objects to which you map the unique objects in a way that is useful to support your planning, which has to be very flexible in the natural world. Whereas in the artificial world, you can be much more rigid in your planning. So because there is no true set structure, no true logical structure to the natural world, of course, the conceptualization, the optimal conceptualization, will depend on the particular species or individual involved. It's whatever's useful. And finally, of course, it's all very well talking about objects, but even objects don't exist in the natural world. See, every object is a meta-object, which are breakable and deformable as a result. And that means that, so the objects can be broken apart and new objects can be formed from those objects. And this might sound like some kind of minor point, but it's really not. It's actually how life works at a fundamental level. Every living thing exists because it takes things, breaks them apart, and reassembles them in different ways. That's true of bacteria and all the rest. Perhaps viruses are perhaps the only thing, because we don't even agree that viruses are alive. But if we set viruses to one side, every other living thing, this is how it works. And at higher levels, like in our own human history, it was also fundamental to the evolution of the human species. This ability to be able to take things apart and reassemble them into tools, for example, is literally what kind of defines modern, well, in fact, defines human beings, the whole Homo genus. And, you know, for the earlier species of humans, we classify them according to how they alter flints to create tools and so on. So it's absolutely fundamental. So that sounds really bad. It just sounds like the natural world is really hard. But on the other hand, to compensate for that everything in the natural world emerges from the same underlying set of rules and processes. It goes back a little bit to like what Jan LeCun was saying yesterday in his keynote about needing this model of the world. Because so every single challenge that is faced by every organism on Earth occurs within the same world, that the dynamics of which emerge from the same set of rules. Now, of course, there's many levels to that emergence. And what happens is we get kind of proxy laws that appear at every level. And so it means then that although at the micro level in nature, the rules are very fuzzy and the objects are hard to classify, when we take the rule set overall, then there's a lot more structure to that set of rules and there isn't a lot of, it's much less arbitrary than a lot of artificial environments. And this then allows for interpolation and extrapolation based on experience much more confidently in the natural world than in many artificial environments, or certainly arbitrary training environments. And at a higher level, like in us humans, it's what has enabled science and invention and so on. But it's also easy to forget that the world is absolutely soaked in biology, in ecology. So there's a lot more to the natural world than just the physical aspects of it. And this is obviously where, this is how I spent most of my life thinking about ecology. The world is absolutely covered in all kinds of teeming, thriving, interacting organisms that are living and evolving and learning all the time. So what are the consequences of that? Well, one of the consequences at the simplest level is that, to a first approximation, every problem in nature is a multi-agent problem. The whole idea of having a single agent interacting with a, if you like, a sterile, non-evolving, non-learning environment is just never happens in nature. So looking at the consequences there, let's have a look at first at the bodies of those organisms. The first thing to notice is that they all have to balance their need for multiple resources. You never get a kind of single resource problem in nature either. In the case of plants, it's water, nutrients, sunlight, CO2, and so on. In animals, it's different forms of proteins, fats, and water. And minerals. One story which I think is really shocking, I remember learning this as an undergrad, is that there's a Hebridean island which has a resident population of deer. Now, we all know that deer are herbivores, right? But those deer sometimes get short on calcium. And when they get short on calcium, they eat the heads of chicks. So they find little baby birds, and they just eat their heads because the head has the highest ratio of bone to volume. So they crunch the skulls, basically, of these of these chicks in order to supplement their diet. And we see a lot of those sorts of behaviors across nature, like in the African rainforest, for example. There are areas called salt licks, where elephants go just to lick the soil to get the minerals. And all of these resources that organisms are trying to get are also packaged by other organisms. They're all biotic in origin and form. So a special case of resource limitation is energy limitation. So in nature, of course, all actions cost energy. That's probably pretty obvious. But also sensing the environment and performing computation is surprisingly expensive. Don't forget, under my definition of intelligence, that's not just limited to the brain. So in our species, the brain does take a lot of our metabolism. But in all species, various forms of computation take huge amounts of the metabolism. And one of the consequences of that is that there's been very strong selection for energy efficiency, and doing nothing is often the best action. Now, ecology really begins when we think about the fact that organisms reproduce. I'm going to have to speed up a bit now, I think, aren't I? It's a bit sorry about that. So successful organisms reproduce. So survival of the fittest, right? And that seems quite familiar, but it's really important to realize the consequences of that. It means that if there's a successful innovation in nature that is bulked up at the community scale, I think that bit's probably quite familiar to most people in this room. It's the basis of a lot of evolutionary computation. But as that occurs, the individuals with that innovation naturally become less successful as they compete with each other for resources. But on the other hand, those resources are always, there's not just one resource in nature, but many. And that means that competition only occurs within what we call the same niche. So in this diagram here, if you imagine the X dimension is some axis of resources, like soil depth or the kind of the metabolism that you use if you're a bacteria, for example. And then on the Y axis is how efficient you are at extracting that resource. Species spread out along these axes and form these niches. And what that means then is if we get an innovation within niche C, then that innovation is bulked up, but we don't lose the diversity in the other niches. We only lose the redundant innovation, the redundant information that's sitting in the community. And this idea of niches is probably the single most important idea in ecology. My colleague Lindsay Turbull calls it the dark matter of ecology. She says that physicists can only explain the fact that galaxies don't fly apart by invoking dark matter, and we ecologists can only explain the fact that ecosystems don't fall apart by evoking niches. I think she's quite right. It's important to realize that most of those resources that we're talking about are actually other organisms. So every organism, every predator has predators or parasites of its own, and all plants have herbivores, etc. And this has interesting consequences because it means that the width, if you like, or even the dimensionality of that niche axis is not fixed by the physical environment, but can just keep increasing without limit. So as various species break into different niches, they then provide additional resources for yet more species. And this has gone on for billions of years. And the result is that ecosystems are staggeringly diverse. So really, one of the least exciting figures in the talk, I think it's fair to say, except if you look at the details. So for example, down there, we can see that there are a total of about 8.8 million different species on land alone, of which we've so far named 1.2 million. So most of them are not named, far less measured in any way. And we have another 2.2 million-ish. This is a very rigorous estimate from one of my colleagues, Derek Tittensaw, was involved in this estimate. So I suggest you check out the paper as to how we actually know that, but it's quite a convincing argument. But of course, it's not just the number of species. Species are very different in the things they eat, the way they behave, their degree of sociality and their diet. And that then also leads to a huge diversity in habitat and the physical structure, which is often dominated by organisms anyway. So of course, that's all very well. I pointed out lots of differences between the physical and between the artificial and natural world as far as the physical side. And I've talked about some of the things that make the natural world special in terms of the ecology, but why would it encourage intelligence? What's the role of intelligence here? And I think we can use this idea of the niches, it's a speculative suggestion, to look at four different ways in which intelligence helps individuals be more successful. And broadly, I'm going to go through this very quickly, but the idea is that niche depth is about becoming better at what you already do well. It's a bit like narrow AI, as we call it. The idea of a niche shift is that intelligence enables you to flexibly adapt your environment to realize that you should shift your niche somewhere else. Niche breadth is something that allows you to actually capture a wider range of resources. And finally, we have this idea of niche creation. Great, that's good. And this is, for me, the more exciting one. This is what we humans have done, which is that you completely change the game and open up an entirely new dimension to the competition between the individuals. And so, for instance, when we discovered the use of fossil fuels, that's a really good example of niche creation, where suddenly we just find a completely new source of energy. Unfortunately, with some downsides, but with many upsides too. And in fact, there are many species that do this niche creation in nature. We're not the only ones, but we're the kind of ultimate niche creators. Okay, so what? So hopefully I've been able to give you an idea that there are at least some potentially interesting differences between the natural and artificial world that could make us rethink how we develop various methods in AI and create environments for training them. Here they are again, Max's beautiful illustrations. And what I'm not saying is that we firstly, of course, this hasn't come clear, I'm not in any way saying that we shouldn't be doing research in artificial environments. I think you'd have to be an idiot to think that, really. but it has gone under the radar a little bit, these naturalistic elements in AI research to date. But the point is, we don't have to build some simulacrum of the whole of nature to make progress here. We could take any one of these things, or do them in pairs or triplets, and look at what effect they have by themselves. So, for instance, energy limitation, it might mean that we charge our agents in the same units as the reward function for every time they sense the environment, for every unit of computation. Or when it comes to the idea of fuzziness, we can just make sure that every object in the environment is unique in size, shape, or texture. And the need to do these kinds of surgical experiments to create environments tailored with these different features is just one more reason why we need flexible platforms for building environments to train AIs. And so it's with a lot of pleasure and some surprise that I find myself announcing that DeepMind Lab just went live on GitHub, or we'll do in Andrew, you're there. It just went live on GitHub. So to put that in perspective, after the progress on the Atari suite of games in DeepMind, which you're probably aware of, which is a very varied set of computer games, DeepMind decided that in addition to continuing the study of that of varied sets of tasks like that, it needed to invest in a single consistent platform that could provide a range of tasks, but all within the same overall world, as something that would be a way to surgically test and push the AIs in specific things like memory or planning or navigation, but where all of those tasks are emerging from the same world, which allows for transfer and more general learning. And having worked on that internally for a long time, and adopting that approach was quite transformative internally to DeepMind's research, being able to create these customized environments. Having worked on that for a long time, we considered that it was mature enough now to release to the community under open source. So this customizable platform for creating environments is now available to researchers. And to give you a little idea about what that looks like, I have a video here. This is from my colleague Max Jardeberg. Now, I should say that obviously as a platform, it could look like anything, but alongside the platform, we've released many example levels. And so this gives you an idea of the look and feel, these nice colorful textures, which vary and actually change through time as well. There are challenges like collecting fruits in a maze or having to navigate along a long, thin corridor and so on. So it gives you an idea about what the level currently looks and feels like, what the environments that we're releasing alongside the platform currently look and feel like. But because it's open source, it's an extensible platform. And so it could be used to experiment with some of these naturalistic elements, like I was talking about through most of my talk, as well as, of course, used in many other directions. That's the point of open sourcing it. It'll be interesting to see what you researchers do with it. But to give you an example of a recent experiment that I was involved in, this is where we've taken that same platform and extended it in a naturalistic direction. So this is a desert scene here, and it's scaleless in the sense that it's a fractal terrain, so no more flat surfaces. It's fuzzy in the sense that the cacti and shrubs are all different from each other in size and shape, and it's also fractal in the shapes of those cacti and shrubs. And it's emergent in the sense that the placement of the cacti and shrubs on the landscape emerges from a set of ecological rules to do with habitat preferences, competition among the plants, and so on. So this is just just an internal experiment that we've been trying. It's been interesting, and what my colleague Max has been able to do here is take that environment, and he literally pointed his standard Unreal agent at that environment, and that's what you're seeing here. So what was quite exciting is this agent has done fairly well at learning to forage in this environment. It looks very lifelike to me, the way it moves around, and it looks a little bit stuck. Down on the bottom left there, that's the value function. So you can see when the value function is bumping along the floor, when it hasn't found a reward, and then it spots a reward, and it goes off, and the closer it gets, the value function comes up, and all of this kind of exciting stuff. So it's been quite thrilling, really, to see that, that it is possible to create quite naturalistic environments on top of this platform, and secondly, that our in-house agents within DeepMind seem to be capable of making some progress within those environments also. But as I said, that's just a very early experiment. And with that, I'll finish. So thanks very much for listening. I really appreciate that. Do check out DeepMind Lab. A huge thanks to Max Kant, our illustrator. It's been such a pleasure working with him. And actually, do you know what? This is the wrong slide. I wanted this one as well, because this also has some homework for you that you can look over at your leisure. But okay, sincerely, thanks very much for listening.
So we have time for questions. If you want to ask questions, please come up to one of the microphones.
Hi. So thank you for an extraordinarily thought-provoking talk. I wanted to ask you about something tangential that you had said about a better analogy for deep learning being networks of genes rather than networks of neurons. I'm just curious, why did you think that?
Yes, a good question. I mean, I think I came at this quite naively, so I don't have a background in deep learning. And one of the things I was quite shocked to learn was that, now this, okay, I know we're making progress all the time, but at the time when I had this first conversation, once you trained a network, in this case, to do image classification, it was very hard to get it to change the categories afterwards, to say, to learn that the cat, you could break a cat into a wild cat and a domestic cat, for example. And I was really shocked at that. I was like, well, that seems to be the very essence of how a brain works, right? That we're able to alter our own concepts and kind of flexibly adjust the way we think through our lifetimes. And so it seemed to me that whereas if you look at the way that networks of genes develop, have learned in nature, then you can imagine in a way that each learning step is like the entire lifetime of an organism, is one way to think about it, right? So within the lifetime of one organism, the network is fixed, and you have this very rapid translation from inputs to outputs, and through evolutionary time, those weights can become evolved, but within the lifetime of an individual, they're very fixed. So that was just, I mean, that's kind of how it struck me, that actually if you think about, so, you know, in what happens with the survival of the fittest, under natural selection and so on, is you have mutations that create a suite of individuals that differ in the weights on their genetic networks, and the ones that are successful thrive, and the ones that are least successful are not kept. And so it looked at in that level, it really looks like you're effectively training a network. It's also important to remember that under the way that works in nature, training genetic networks, it's okay for individuals to catastrophically fail many times against the same task before they finally learn to succeed. Whereas if you look at the way a human works, you know, I don't write, so for example, if you get, you know, it's perfectly acceptable in some forms of RL, for example, to train something to ride a bike and it just keeps riding off a cliff a million times before it finally learns to not ride off a cliff. You can't do that as a human, right? But actually through evolutionary time, you can. There will have been all kinds of organisms that had the wrong genetic networks and simply had the wrong responses to the environment and simply died. And then a small number of those eventually managed to succeed. And so, yeah, they were the two thoughts, catastrophic failure and the lack of flexibility within a single lifetime. Now, of course, having said that, as we all know, I mean, and I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, obviously we're all excited, it seems, about things like LSTMs and RNNs that allow, you know, memories and states to build up within the life of an organism. And that then obviously starts to take us closer to something a bit like the brain. But then again, as I mentioned in my talk, all cells actually hold internal states also. So we shouldn't think of genetic networks as a simple feed-forward network, anything but. They also have a memory and store internal states. So So it'd be interesting just to explore some of those analogies, I think, without jumping all the way to the brain every time. So thanks for the question.
Question here. Back to your left over here. So I have a question about artificial emotions. I know nominally machine learning is about artificial intelligence, but it seems like emotions play a role implicitly, and I'm not sure they're well defined. I mean, the word motion comes from the same root as motor, or urge, or drive. Perhaps the value functions you described are the precursors of emotions. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, actually. And one of the things we've been talking about a bit, I have a colleague, Chrysantha, who's very interested in evolution, is the idea that actually in nature, there is no such thing as a reward function, right? Nature does not give you a single number that you can optimize against. What we actually have is a rich sensory input, and I think this was explained again in Jan's talk yesterday. We have a rich sensory input, which through our own internal calculations, we decide makes us happy or sad, and we turn into a reward function. Now, of course, where do those things come from? And I think in the majority of organisms on Earth, those reward functions are evolved. So through natural selection, we've been able to find these reward functions, like I said, emotion calculators or what have you, that lead to evolutionary success, that lead to fitness. So you know, if you have a desire to explore and a desire for mates, and you like sugary, protein-rich food or something, these are kind of emotional responses to your environment. It turns out that you become successful evolutionarily through time. So this is it's a slightly different way of thinking about it. So, and it raises a whole interesting idea about how we tailor reward functions, internal reward functions within the organisms that might achieve at the population level something that we think is desirable. So it's interesting to think about, you know, what would be the reward functions in, a multi-agent setting that would lead to cooperative behaviors, for example. And one last thought I would throw in, by the way, is I personally think hormones are really interesting, like emotional hormones. They seem to be these various, and again, I'm not a neuroscientist or a psychologist, but these seem to be quite an interesting, again, we have so some of our emotional reactions to the environment are very short term, but the hormones are a slower response to the environment, which also change our behaviors. And I suppose I'd finally add that in humans, of course, that it seems that we can actually consciously change our own personal reward functions to some extent. And that might be something that you get when you have a brain as big as ours, is that we can actually reprogram our own reward functions if we want to. So thanks. So I think it's fascinating.
So we have one last question.
Okay, thank you, Drew, for this great talk. Something I've been giving a lot of thought to is creating a curriculum on machine learning for children. And so you seem like a good person to ask with your illustrations as well as your deep mind thing, but I'm talking about supervised and RL. Curriculum for children. I wonder if you could riff on that for a minute.
Well, I think we'd all agree that we're people limited in this whole area, right? And certainly from the perspective in Britain, you know, I think I'm not the only person that's worried about the lack of young people moving into some of these areas. And I think Britain, compared to some other countries, put quite a lot of effort in. So I completely agree that would be an absolutely fantastic thing to do. It's an incredibly exciting area. There's a huge economic and societal demand for these skills, thinking more practically. So I think it would be fantastic to do. As to how to structure that, I think that's a bit harder. I mean, we have some colleagues that take an interest in that and have visited schools, and we had an email thread sharing best practices. And they said that, you know, so they had various fun activities that you could carry out to interest perhaps the youngest children. So yeah, but I can't think it's not something I thought about too much, but I think it's really important. And I think one of the things I really love about the technology sector that I've sort of drifted into from ecology, and I think it's really well represented here, is that actually it's highly cooperative. And we see that, you know, with all of this open sourcing of various platforms and various institutions, right, and all open publishing of results and so on. So I think you're right, we could reach out a little bit lower and bring even more people into that cooperative network. There's one more thing I would add, by the way, which is there are actually two young people on the front row here that I met yesterday who are high school students. They've actually come to NIPS because they're excited about ML and AI, and they've been doing like TensorFlow in their bedrooms. And so here they are, the two of them. And so, you know, a massive thumbs up to them, and that shows you that, you know, the future's bright if we get it right. So thanks.
Okay, thank you very much for this great talk.
Thank you.